It's already one of the most dangerous places to explore for oil and gas. And this just, one, it makes it easier to drill, and two, it makes it even more dangerous.
A bill that would help open Arctic waters to more oil drilling moves in Congress. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 8th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, getting the word out about the Affordable Care Act in the age of misinformation.
There's a lot of people who actually think we no longer have the Affordable Care Act, which we in fact do, and it's still exactly the same as it was for the prior years.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
A deregulation bill aimed at boosting energy production on federal lands cleared a U.S. House committee today, known as the Secure American Energy Act. The bill would remove several limits on Arctic drilling. It would undo former President Obama's decision to close off most Arctic waters to leasing, and it would allow states to take over management of oil and gas development on federal land. Alaska Congressman Don Young says states would do a better job because Young claims federal employees try to block development.
They don't want to drill oil. I wish they'd just fess up to it, then at least we know for sure that where their loyalty lies. But I really believe if we don't continue to do what we need to do in Alaska and the western states, that we will fall back in that trap of having be dependent upon the Middle East countries.
Young says he also likes that the bill would share offshore revenues with coastal states. Alaska would get 37.5% of the proceeds from leasing and development in federal Arctic waters. But Katie Siddell of the Wilderness Society says the bill is part of a broader sellout campaign.
This is a bill that is par for the course in what we're seeing out of not just the House, but the Senate and the administration on trying to drill anywhere these guys can and hand off our public lands to private interests.
Siddell says if states take over as regulators on federal lands, the public would lose transparency and opportunities to weigh in. Siddell says one of the bill's worst provisions is that it would scrap the 2016 safety rules for offshore Arctic drilling.
It's already one of the most dangerous places to explore for oil and gas, and this just, one, it makes it easier to drill, and two, it makes it even more dangerous.
Young says the Obama administration's Arctic drilling regs make future exploration nearly impossible. The Secure bill now moves to the House floor. It is sponsored by House Majority Whip Steve Scalise of Louisiana. His leadership position makes it likely the bill will be brought up for a vote. Senator Lisa Murkowski today released legislation that would open part of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. If approved by the Senate Energy Committee she chairs, the refuge provision would become part of the Senate Budget Reconciliation Bill, along with the Republican tax cuts. Murkowski's part of the bill would lift the ban on drilling in the so-called 1002 area along the coastal plain. It would split revenues 50-50 between the state and federal government. The Alaska Statehood Compact calls for a 90-10 split favoring the state. But Governor Bill Walker said last week he's fine with an even split if it leads to the long-sought development in the refuge. Murkowski says the Congressional Budget Office has concluded the legislation would raise more than $1 billion over 10 years, which was a requirement under the budget plan Congress passed. She plans to debate the measure in her committee next Wednesday. Most of the panel's Democrats ardently oppose drilling in the refuge. Only one Democrat on the committee, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, is on the record in favor of ANWR drilling. Still, there's little doubt Murkowski has the votes to advance the measure to the Senate floor. President Donald Trump's administration has asked Congress to fund a fourth missile defense silo field at Fort Greely. The Fairbanks Daily Newsminer reports that Trump wrote a letter to Congress on Monday requesting $200 million to build the defense field. Fort Greely is home to most of the United States ground-based mid-course missile interceptors, which are designed to protect the United States by intercepting long-range missiles as they fly outside the atmosphere. Trump wrote that the request is a part of additional efforts to detect, defeat, and defend against any North Korean use of ballistic missiles. The defense field is just a piece of the $5.9 billion Trump wants added to this year's budget, $4 million of which was requested for missile defense and North Korea-related military spending. Health insurance can be expensive, boring, and frustrating. But for the next 5 weeks, people can buy insurance from the federal marketplace, and one Alaskan is on a mission to make sure those bad feelings can't stop good coverage. KHNS's Barrett Wilbur reports.
Most people's eyes don't light up at the prospect of buying health insurance. Susan Bryles is the exception.
I mean, we're out there making sure that as many people have coverage as can get it.
As an outreach and enrollment specialist for Search, she's holed up downstairs at the Haynes Clinic, explaining deductibles, premiums, and copays like it's her job, which it is. Bryles is here because the enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act just opened. Alaskans have until December 15th to buy health insurance. Her job's gotten a little harder this year.
There's a lot of people who actually think we no longer have the Affordable Care Act, which we in fact do, and it's still exactly the same as it was for the prior years. But there's a lot more misinformation out there than there used to be.
Given the polka dot geography of Southeast, it's a logistical challenge to inform people about enrollment. On top of that, Bryles says the federal government cut her advertising budget 90% this year. And the sign-up window was halved.
When the Affordable Care Act first came into being, we used to have 3 months to get people enrolled. Now we have 6 weeks.
So Bryles is on a whirlwind tour of Southeast to get people covered and clarify misconceptions.
With the framework that the Affordable Care gives us, insurance companies have to operate by a much stricter set of rules.
For instance, insurers have to cover pre-existing conditions. In Southeast, that often means diabetes or cancer, she says, as well as things like asthma or high blood pressure. And insurers can't limit the costs they'll cover. Despite those benefits, Alaskans are used to getting bad news about healthcare. The small, dispersed population, high cost of business, and limited competition help make Alaskans' care some of the most expensive in the nation. After the ACA passed, Alaska's premium rates have climbed by nearly a third each year since 2014, until this year.
I've done the marketplace insurance ever since it was started. My rates probably dropped 25% from last year.
Beth Fenhouse makes beer at the Haynes Brewing Company. She's not a high-cost patient. She's young, healthy, and has barely used her insurance since signing up 4 years ago. She's saving money this year because Alaska got permission to keep running its reinsurance program. Alaska sets aside a pot of money to pay for its most expensive patients. Premiums are lower for healthy people, so the federal government doesn't have to pay as much in tax subsidies. Then the feds can use the savings to reimburse Alaska some of the money it set aside in the first place. Though Funhouse hasn't needed her insurance, she doesn't regret signing up. She works an active job and skis all winter in Haynes, far from any hospitals. Insurance gives her the power to stop worrying.
I think it's kind of just that realization that you have at this time of your life. You know, you're trying to concentrate on building a savings and building a home. And
Susan Bryles would agree. It's exactly those kinds of worries she wants people to focus on instead of healthcare. In Haynes, I'm Barrett Wilbur.
An airman attached to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson died on a training mission overseas on Monday. In a statement, a spokesman for the Air Force at JBEAR says 23-year-old Airman First Class Derek Jones collapsed while on a temporary assignment in South Korea. Though nearby service members tried to revive him, they were unsuccessful. The cause of Jones' death isn't yet known. Jones worked with water and fuel systems as part of a civil engineering unit. He joined the Air Force a little more than 2 years ago and was assigned to JBEAR last summer. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the life of a journalist before the age of Google.
When I was beginning in the field, you just learned to cultivate your sources, call people up, find out things.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
Open enrollment for the health insurance marketplace in Alaska is now through Friday, December 15th. Enrollment assistance is available and it's free. Visit getcoveredalaska.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust.
An ash plume drifting from a Russian volcano has prompted flight cancellations in northern Alaska. William Walsh, a spokesman for Raven Alaska, says the airline canceled flights today to and from Kotzebue and Dead Horse, the supply hub for the Prudhoe Bay oil fields. Alaska Airlines officials say no flights were immediately affected. Dave Schneider with the Alaska Volcano Observatory says the cloud originated from the Shevluk volcano on Russia's Kamchatka Peninsula, which erupted Tuesday, sending an ash cloud about 26,000 feet into the atmosphere. The plume drifted over parts of northern Alaska today. The volcano is about 1,300 miles southwest of Kotzebue. The ash plume prompted the National Weather Service to issue volcanic ash advisories in Alaska. Ash clouds above 20,000 feet can harm aircraft. Anchorage drivers will see a slight bump at the pump early next year. At its Tuesday night meeting, the Anchorage Assembly voted for a new excise tax on gasoline and diesel fuel. Motorists will pay an extra 10 cents a gallon starting in March of 2018. The measure is expected to generate around $14 million a year in revenue, but the move does not increase overall taxes for residents. In keeping with recommendations from the city's Budget Advisory Council, the new charge falls under the municipality's tax cap, and money collected will offset property taxes. According to the mayor's administration, the average homeowner in Anchorage will see a drop in their property tax bill of $131. For drivers, the ordinance's sponsors calculated it will mean an extra $43 per year. Assembly Chair Dick Traney, a major supporter of the measure, says the aim is to take some of the tax burden off property owners.
Our chance tonight is to diversify the income stream coming into this town.
The measure passed 10-1, along with an amendment to adjust the tax for inflation. The meeting also heard public testimony on the administration's 2018 budget, which the Assembly will vote on later this month. A large number of people asked the Assembly to consider approving more money for drug treatment. Supporters and staff from the Alaska AIDS Assistance Association testified on how extra municipal funds could expand the organization's syringe exchange program, decreasing risk and public health costs among injection drug users. In 2 weeks, when the Assembly finalizes the city's budget, they'll also be taking testimony on a proposal to add a new 2% tax on alcohol to pay for substance abuse treatment. Though the state taxes alcohol, officials in Anchorage have long complained the revenues don't adequately fund treatment. Fairbanks and Juneau both collect local taxes on alcohol sales, according to the memorandum submitted by Traney, who introduced the ordinance. Fairbanks has long struggled with how best to help people who regularly drink too much and end up endangered on city streets. Community Service Patrol officers routinely bring chronic inebriates to the hospital or jail. But this month, Fairbanks has a new option, a sobering center. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Drinking too much alcohol can endanger you any time of the year, but during the winter in Fairbanks, the combination of being drunk and on the street in sub-zero cold can be deadly. That's why the Tanana Chiefs Conference is opening a special facility.
For up to 12-hour stretches to sober up and have a safe place to shelter.
TCC's Shirley Lee has shepherded development of the Sobering Center, which is located off Airport Way in the DiNardo Center, a former mental health facility owned by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. At a ribbon-cutting Monday, Lee recounted what motivated the Sobering Center project the winter of 2007-2008, when seven people froze to death in Fairbanks.
And I'll share one story about one of those individuals who passed away. She passed away Christmas morning. She had gone to church and stayed at that church as long as she could for Christmas Eve services until the building was no longer open. And by the next morning, she was dead because she didn't have a place to go because she had been drinking.
Efforts by TCC, the Trust Authority, and local partners, including Fairbanks Memorial Hospital and the City of Fairbanks, yielded a three-year, $500,000 state grant to realize the 12-bed facility. Lee says TCC is modeling it after a successful sobering center in Bethel.
The neat thing about this program is once the our guests have been here and they've sobered up, we will offer them the chance to have an ESPRT screening, which is screening for...
Screening, brief intervention, and referral for treatment.
Sobering Center Manager Jamie Noble says the screening includes specific questions about alcohol use.
And then we're also going to be asking about domestic violence, depression, and recreational drug use, as well as tobacco use, and trying to give them the referral, or not the referrals, but the resources that they need.
Noble says that provides a path to recovery. In the past, people picked up on local streets were typically jailed or taken to the hospital, depending on their condition. That'll still happen for those who've committed crimes or are in medical danger, but City Mayor Jim Matherly says the Sobering Center will provide more appropriate care in most other cases.
That's the hole that's been there. You had the extreme of the hospital or the not extreme of just the police station, and what do you do in either one? If you're in the middle, that's what this will serve. It's going to plug that hole.
Mayor Matherly and representatives of other project partners emphasized that local support will be required to keep the Sobering Center operating beyond the three-year state grant. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Just as overnight temperatures in Anchorage are beginning to dip into the teens and single digits, an area nonprofit abruptly announced today it won't be able to shelter some of the city's homeless this winter. Beans Cafe is a soup kitchen in downtown Anchorage. Last year, for the first time in its history, Beans opened its doors as an overflow shelter just as cold winter weather bared down on the city. Anchorage was already struggling with a severe shortage of shelter beds for adults, but Lisa Souder, executive director of Beans Cafe, says today the organization's board decided that was not feasible to do again this winter.
We were notified by our insurer that that led to many issues because it was a usage change for our building and led to us ultimately getting dropped by our insurance carrier. And it's just unfortunately not something that fits with our core mission right now.
Souder says that core mission is fighting hunger. The decision means there will be 50 less beds available for people seeking overnight shelter. The municipality of Anchorage has a cold weather plan that goes into effect when temperatures drop below freezing. Souder said this afternoon she conveyed the change to officials with the city, but had not yet received a response. Meanwhile, Southeast Alaska's largest city will open a warming center for the homeless later this month. The Juneau Assembly approved an ordinance appropriating $75,000 to the project at its Monday meeting. The center will open once the temperature drops below freezing. The warming center will operate through April in an old Department of Public Safety building near Juneau's Centennial Hall Convention Center. It's expected to hold about 25 people. Funding will come from municipal tobacco tax revenues. Ketchikan City Council also voted this fall to fund a seasonal warming center for homeless residents. The amount appropriated was $80,000.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI Business, with complete GCI data solutions for Alaska's most important organizations. GCI is your partner in possibilities. Thinking about completing your college degree? Good news, you can finish it right here at the University of Alaska. Go after your dream by earning a bachelor's, master's, a certificate, or an associate degree at the University of Alaska. Flexible classes, convenient schedules, affordable choices, and outstanding faculty, the university has it all. It's your choice, your dream. See how the University of Alaska can help you achieve it at alaska.edu/start here. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
The 10th annual Matsu Salmon Science and Conservation Symposium kicked off today in Palmer. It's a gathering of fish biologists, conservationists, and policymakers put on by the Matsu Salmon Habitat Partnership. The goal is to keep salmon healthy by connecting varying interests to share ideas through panel discussions, networking, and a storytelling event called Salmon Live Here, Stories of the Fish We Love. One discussion about the spawning grounds of salmon harvested commercially in Cook Inlet is a hot topic for the Mat-Su Borough, where officials say commercial fishing operations in Cook Inlet catch a disproportionate amount of salmon trying to get to Mat-Su rivers and streams. Keynote speaker Dr. Tara Martin, a conservation scientist at the University of British Columbia, says bridging the gap between science and action is a challenge in Alaska, as it is elsewhere.
I see that as a huge problem, and I think as scientists, we haven't done ourselves any favors in working to translate our data into things that are useful for decision making.
Martin says conservation scientists are often simply documenting the effects of development on salmon and releasing their research. Instead, she says, they should also identify strategies to improve outcomes.
The translation needs to go from the scientific world and really plant it in the people world, which is about socioeconomics.
Martin has researched declining salmon runs in British Columbia's Fraser River, and she sees opportunities to avoid similar salmon problems in the Mat-Su, despite its rapid population growth and associated development.
Most other regions in the world don't have thriving salmon populations anymore. So I think with some very proactive management and collaboration, there's a real opportunity to do things differently.
More than 100 people attended Martin's keynote address this morning. The Salmon Symposium continues tomorrow at the Palmer Community Center. An Alaska journalist with decades of experience in reporting on business and the oil industry has been selected as the next University of Alaska Anchorage Atwood Chair of Journalism. Tim Bradner started reporting in Alaska in the mid-60s. Bradner is the co-publisher of the Alaska Legislative Digest and Alaska Economic Report. He is a prolific journalist who files for numerous other state newspapers. He also worked in the past for BP Alaska in public affairs. As Atwood Chair, Bradner says one of the classes he'll teach is called public service journalism.
When I was a cub reporter, I learned very quickly at the hard task under a very strict taskmaster, a city editor, really three fundamental things that I think are really important, not only for young reporters, but I think are broadly... I consider them life skills. One is the ability to write quickly, to write concisely, to write lean, and be able to just sit down and get something out, get a piece of text out, and not have to kind of wait around and be struck by the inspiration for it. The second skill is to learn to be able to find out things quickly. Of course, these days with the internet and Google, it's made easier, but when I was beginning in the field, you just learn to cultivate your sources, call people up, find out things. That's, I think, a pretty crucial thing. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing is simply, you know, not to be afraid of authority figures. And, you know, part of that is really don't be afraid to ask dumb questions. You have to educate yourself. So anyway, I consider those life skills, particularly the dumb questions part.
You're going to be giving a talk as you haven't taken over as the Atwood Chair yet. That starts in January. But you're giving a talk on Thursday evening titled, Where Did Alaska's Oil Money Go? Tell us about this talk. What's going to be on the agenda?
Well, this as part of the Atwood Chair, I have an obligation to give a lecture or two or even three during the course of the year. And I have done this before, in a sense, maybe perhaps not as formal as this kind of setting will be, but this is the topic of this summer I did a 10-part series on the kind of the evolution of Alaska during the oil era as part of the 40th anniversary of, you know, Prudhoe Bay and the North Slope. But one of the art pieces I did is Where Did the Money Go? And really, I started off with just a piece that the best work on this, actually where the money has gone, has been done by the university's Institute of Social and Economic Research by Scott Goldsmith. So I sort of took that as a takeoff point. and just talked about some of the things over the years that we have spent money on. And we've spent a lot of it. It was a big party. And of course, now it's a different, certainly a different time, which shows you how what goes up comes down sometimes with a thud. But, you know, we've been here before. 1986 and 87, recession was a very tough time. And oil prices were down. People were losing their jobs. But we bounced back. I'm not saying that this isn't going to be different, though.
Was it a mistake, do you think, in reference to where has the money gone? Was it a mistake to get rid of an income tax? If people have their own sort of skin in the game, their own dollars in the game, do they pay more attention to how money gets spent and big buildings being built?
I think we probably should have retained the income tax, Laurie, and Governor Hammond agrees with that. He has often said that he wished that it had been not repealed completely, but just maybe minimized and taken back down to 1%. So when a time came that we could resurrect it and bring it back. So that's a difficult debate we're going through right now. We're having to make that transition from the point that where oil pays for everything to where oil pays for just part of things. And, you know, we're always going to have an oil patch on the North Slope, and we'll always have, you know, hopefully well into the future, we'll always have a substantial amount of oil income to our treasury. But there's a gap, and it varies depending on the year and the price of oil. We think now we can use perhaps some of the permanent fund earnings to help that. But people, at some point, people are going to have to chip in and help pay for government. That's a difficult conversation that we're having, and we will continue to have until we actually find a way to do it.
UAA Atwood Chair of Journalism Tim Bradner will give a talk tomorrow evening about how Alaska has used its revenue over four decades. Bradner will speak at the university's Consortium Library. His talk is entitled, Where Did Alaska's Oil Money Go? And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Barrett Wilbur in Haines, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Casey Grove in Palmer, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ExxonMobil Alaska. Their financial investment and partnership with local companies at Point Thompson helps contribute to Alaska's economy and jobs for Alaskans. ExxonMobil, energy lives here. Do you need health insurance but think you can't afford it? Alaska's health insurance premiums are going down for 2018. If you need insurance or currently have insurance through the individual market, be sure to shop at healthcare.gov between November 1st and December 15th to confirm that you have the plan that best meets your family's budget and coverage needs. For local assistance, call 1-844-PLANS-AK. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance. Colder temperatures are here, and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation reminds you of the danger of carbon monoxide, a poisonous gas that you can't see or smell. If it builds up in your home, it can be deadly. Be safe this winter and have a qualified mechanic ensure your heating system is working properly. Never run your car in the garage or operate a portable generator in an enclosed space. Finally, always ensure your home has a working carbon monoxide detector. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.